Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Dukmasova, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time in the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it is Saturday, April 20th. April 20th, 2024. I've lost track of time. Yeah, it's one of those rare Saturday recordings that we do. Actually, not that rare anymore. Producer Nate, we've been doing them more and more. Trying to accommodate guest schedules. As I always do with a bonus interview, I always start the day with a little headline, what's in the newspaper today, and I'm going to show my distinguished guests. I don't play around. I support local journalists. You look at that, distinguished guests. I support local journalists. I'm one of the few people in the city of Chicago who still subscribes to a newspaper. And in this particular newspaper is the Chicago Sun-Times, my beloved Bright One, delivered every day. So all you Bright One, reporters, editors, photographer. Well, I don't know if there's any photographers here anymore. You're welcome. The headline, burned out, Bulls overmatched. I can't even read it. I don't even want to talk about Alaysia. My beloved Bulls were defeated yesterday by the dreaded Miami Heat, and their season has ended. And I'm going to just wait for next year. But here on another light, show them this. Here's a little interesting story, which I'm sure we'll be talking about further in the week. Johnson's $1.25 billion borrowing plan sails through city council. We've been talking about this in the past. I got a smile on my face. This is the program where he's supposedly going to phase out some TIFs and then spend the money that would ordinarily flow into those TIF bank accounts. That's literally how it happens, ladies and gentlemen, on other things. So for me, it's kind of a happy day. Here's a curious little, I got a kick out of this one sentence in the story though. Critics have long contended the system exacerbates, we're talking about the TIF system. The TIF system exacerbates inequality because areas with high property values often realize the most benefit. Yes, indeed. Critics have long contended that. When I first read that sentence, I go, man, Richard Roper, been writing about TIFs lately. Richard Roper writing TIFs. Roger Ebert write a TIF story. Gary Deeb. Pauline Kim. No, different kind of critic. My distinguished guests are so old, they actually know who Roger Ebert is. I'm not sure if they know who Gary Deeb is. They're not that old, but they definitely know who Richard Roper is and Roger Ebert. Anyway, different kind of critic. Critic like me, a loudmouth, gadfly, whatever I am. But that's a
little opposition from the community.
Yes. Just to tell you, folks, it's indisputable. It's like critics say the sun rises in the east. Yes, the sun rises in the east. And yes, TIFs exacerbate inequalities because the faster a neighborhood gentrifies, the more money goes into the TIF. That's just the way of the program. All right. I'll restrain myself and ask my distinguished guests to introduce themselves. And we're going to have a conversation having nothing to do with TIFs. So distinguished guests, whose first initial is A, introduce yourself.
Hi, Ben. Abdon Palish, former Sun-Times reporter, now Director of Communications for the Illinois Office of Comptroller.
What up, Susanna Mendoza? I know you're listening to this conversation. Distinguished guest whose first initial is B. Introduce yourself.
Bob Hergeth, Chicago Sun-Times. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Okay. He's an investigative reporter for the show. What are you guys? It's something like you're in a witness protection program. I'm only going to say my name. I'm going to suddenly. Abdon Palish, like great political reporter for many, many years for my beloved Bright One, the Chicago Sun-Times. Then he said, to hell with journalism. I can't stand the hours. I want a regular paycheck. He went into government. And let me see if I can do this, Abdon. I can now recite. Oh, my God. Bob Hergeth, this is going to be an amazing feat. Mm-hmm. You worked for Governor Patrick Quinn.
Yep.
Sheriff Tom Dart.
Yep.
Comptroller Susanna Mendoza. Am I correct, sir?
You are correct, sir.
Yes. Bob Hergeth. Bob has been on the show before. He is an investigative reporter extraordinaire for my beloved Bright One. Done a lot of stories about corruption, suburban corruption. He was the FBI file guy. Remember that, ladies and gentlemen? I was obsessed with the FBI. Bob, I actually looked up my father's records to see if the FBI was spying on him. There was no record that they were, which doesn't mean that they weren't. There's just no record that they were, if you follow what I'm saying.
I tried to look up my dad's FBI file too, and I couldn't find anything because he was a reporter and he wrote on the Red Squad at times and stuff like that. So that's interesting. And not to hijack the conversation, but the FBI file, the database that I still maintain for the Sun-Times, is the reason why this podcast actually happened.
Okay, now let's get to that. Let's get to the heart of the matter. And I'm very excited to have him on. These two gentlemen have put together a 12-episode podcast entitled Underbelly, The Rebel Kind. My God, there's so much to discuss. It has to do with an undercover operative from the United States who infiltrates the IRA, reaching the highest levels of the IRA. What a character this guy was. And what a wild story it is. I've listened to two of the episodes, Bob and Abdon, and they're dropping on a weekly basis, I want to say. So we'll just in the most basic sense, we'll start. Bob, why don't you just start? Just give us the basics of the podcast, where people can follow it. So if they get nothing out of this conversation, they get that. Okay. So just take it away, Bob. Go ahead.
We could tell you're a tabloid reader because get to the point, right? Let's slap it out there. The Rebel Kind. It's about a guy with ties to Chicago, used to live in Chicago, who infiltrated a violent faction of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, at a time when the peace process was underway and very tenuous and threatened, with destruction, and sort of, I don't want to say single-handedly saved it, but was certainly played a major role in saving a peace process that sustains to this very day, 25 years later, and Ireland and Northern Ireland are in relative peace and coexistence, the different people within them. And that's what this podcast is about.
Okay. So Abdon, I'll go to you with this one. Just give folks a backdrop, if you will, about what is referred to as the Troubles and the division between the two Irelands. And because, as I was telling Bob before we went on the air, I don't assume any knowledge on anyone's part about something that doesn't exist in the United States. Okay, so you know it well, and Bob knows it well, but our listeners may not, so go ahead.
So the Irish have a good reason to have just a little bit of a grudge against the British. And as I say in the first episode where I interview my mom, you know, the Irish Alzheimer's, you forget everything but a grudge. And I remember growing up hearing my grandmother talking about, you know, when she was a young child being dragged out, you know, on the front porch by the Black and Tans, the, you know, notorious henchmen hired by the Brits to, you know, enforce British justice in Ireland, to watch them drag her uncle to death for teaching Irish. And, you know, my mom remembers that like it's yesterday. It's 100 years ago. So there's the same thing on both sides. If you're a unionist in the North, meaning you favor the union with Great Britain, you consider yourself British, and your father was killed by the IRA, that makes a pretty big impression on you too. So both sides there have these long-held grudges. It's been going on for 800 years when the British first kind of came into Ireland trying to take over. And the current manifestation started in the late 60s when there was relative calm in Northern Ireland, which was sort of an artificial, when the rest of Ireland, there was a revolution of sorts 100 years ago. Most of Ireland won its independence from Britain, but the six northeasternmost counties where there were larger percentages of folks who consider themselves British, be it because of the religion, they were Protestant, not Catholic, because of their background, their people had come from Britain or Scotland, 300 years earlier. They wanted to remain part of the UK. So they carved out that little section that they called Northern Ireland. And it was relatively calm, although not very hospitable for the Catholic minority up there for the next, 60 years or so. In the late 60s, coinciding with the, civil rights movement in the U.S., the Catholics, the Irish in Northern Ireland started standing up for their rights. And that was sort of met with harsh repression from first the unionist population there, and then from the actual government of Britain, which came in and sent soldiers. And so that's all the backdrop for the conflict that leads up to around the time that Dave Rupert's going over there.
Got it. Bob, you want to add anything to that history lesson?
Yeah, just, the breakdown over there is really Catholics versus Protestants, but it's really not a religious, it's not really a religious conflict. Beyond the populations. It's not some theological debate like would have gone on like 500 years ago. It really speaks to power and respect and economics. And, Ireland's its own island adjacent to an island that includes England, Wales, and Scotland. And the English invaded 800 years ago and never left. And, factually oppressed the country for hundreds of years. And by the late 60s, the Irish Catholics were treated, very poorly and had had enough. And they had a civil rights movement based and modeled somewhat on the Black civil rights movement in the U.S. And, it exploded into violence when it was violently crushed in some ways. And the outgrowth of that was, sort of a rebirth of the IRA. The Irish Republican Army, Republican meaning republic, meaning they want the whole island to be one united republic. And then that, 3,500 deaths later, in the mid-90s, both sides, at least elements of both sides, were ready for peace. But the British were not going to allow peace they weren't going to give up their portion of Northern Ireland, which they had kept for, 70 years or whatever it was. But the IRA at least was willing to lay down its weapons with some concessions. But then there were elements of the IRA who were not willing to do that, which spiraled off. And that was who our protagonist, part of the Chicago guy who infiltrated, was really part of and aligned with and infiltrating.
So Bob, just to finish off this history, just so everybody knows, at the moment, as we speak, is it just one unified Ireland, or is it still two Irish states?
It's two. The Northern Ireland. So again, when the Republic, the southern part of the island, gained its independence, it was the British only agreed if they could keep the northern half. And so elements of, of the south, of the Irish Catholics, agreed, and which was the basis, frankly, for a civil war. And so it's very long and complicated, but the bottom line is Northern Ireland is still a British province. And but there are mechanisms in place that were brought about through the peace process in the mid to late 90s that it could be reassumed into the full island in the Republic if voters in both sides of the community and both sides of the island, frankly, want it. And with the Irish birth rate, the Irish Catholic birth rate outpacing the Protestant birth rate up north, that probably, will become a reality at some point, although how, why, where, et cetera, is really hazy.
Abner, before we take a little deeper dive into your podcast, I have to ask you this sort of political question, one that I've struggled with ever since I was a kid in Evanston. Just sort of learning about this, okay? Just being exposed to it from afar. And I really struggle with this one because, as Bob said, the anti-British movement in Northern Ireland was patterned on the civil rights movement in the United States. And Jesse Lewis Jackson, Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, was a hero in Ireland. Malcolm X, I'm not making this up, Abner, was a hero in Ireland. And I really struggle with this as a young kid. Like, so many of the Irish Americans I knew in this country were on the conservative side. They were aligned with Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, listeners, not Baby Daley. And always got to do that, Bob. And so help people understand this, like, contrast between the political ideologies and views of Irish in Ireland and those of Irish in Chicago. Go ahead.
Do you know how it kills me to, you know, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, do you not recognize where you came from? Do you not recognize how much your people struggled? You were on the side of the oppressed. You were not on the side of the oppressors. Why do you not want to join the oppressors? Now, I recognize my white privilege. If I walk down the street in Chicago and a officer of the law passes me, he sees white. He doesn't see, you know, someone whose ancestors were oppressed by the British. So I benefit from that. I am not, you know, immediately suspect as, you know, somewhat darker skin is. So, but I would wish that more Irish Americans did know more about their background and were more in touch with their roots to know which side of the line they should be on when it comes to oppressors versus oppressed. Because, yeah, as you say, all those civil rights icons are icons in Ireland. And I would say a lot of Irish Americans are in touch and are pillars of you know, the right side of, you know, of the movements here in this country.
Yeah. But I'll take it a step further.
See the commitments and watch the part of the commitments.
Yes,
where, you know, I'm black and I'm proud.
Yeah,
you know,
and I'm proud. Yeah.
Great movie about an Irish band that's worth seeing.
Yeah. Great flick. And all right. So I'll take it a step further. Not only are there Irish in Chicago who are very aware of the struggle in Northern Ireland, but they wanted to support it. And this gets into your podcast because this character that you center on, David Rupert, who's still very much alive, began his career, or I don't know if that's a fair way to say it, but got his entrance into the world of the IRA by raising money in Chicago. So, Bob, why don't you talk about that? Talk about the character. Introduce us to the character who is so central to the podcast and the story. This is an extraordinary character whose life is like a parable in many ways. Talk about how he got started in the business of spying on the IRA. Go ahead.
Yeah, as we say in the podcast, it all traces back to a woman, right? And actually a couple women, right? And our main character, a guy named Dave Rupert, grew up in upstate New York. He lived in Chicago for a time, but he was dating an Irish American woman, and they visited Ireland and became very familiar with Ireland. He fell in love with Ireland, went back and forth, and dated another Irish American woman, and went back, and so he just became, even though he's Protestant American and not Irish really at all, he fell in love with the country and sort of, you know, got to know a lot of people, among them just through bar hopping and in relationships and stuff like that through these women, IRA types, IRA supporters, stuff like that. And one day he's back, you know, he's a trucker. He drives trucks, he runs trucking companies, blah, 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 back in the Chicago area. And one day he's there and an FBI agent comes in unannounced and, you know, basically slaps a photo down in front of him and says, "Why are you with this guy?" And the guy he was with was a reputed IRA figure in Ireland that he had been hanging out with overseas over there some time earlier. And our character, Dave, who's you know, is a very likable guy and a very funny guy, but also he's done some shady, he's been involved in some shady industries, companies, projects over the years, was sort of relieved. It's like, oh, is that all it is? just me hanging with a reputed terrorist, you know, could have been much worse. And then the FBI wants him to kind of help him out. And yes. So it starts there.
Have you ever seen the movie American Hustle, Abden?
I have not.
No? Oh, you should definitely see it. Have you seen it, Bob?
No.
All right, end the podcast right now. Run and go see it right now. This is the most
thanks for having us.
I can't believe you guys have never seen American Hustle. I've seen it like 10 times. I've seen it enough for both of you. It's a David Russell movie, but it's about the Abscam scandal, which is before your time. But that's where the FBI got a hustler to set up a scam where they caught New Jersey politicians taking payoffs. But the point is, they got him on something else, and they said, well, while we got you, the FBI nailed him on another scandal having nothing to do with paying off corrupt, who weren't really that corrupt, by the way. I'm down a tangent here, entrapment, but whatever. Paying off New Jersey politicians. We're going to use you to nail these politicians. So it seems like this is what the genesis of David Rupert's connection to this story is. Am I correct in that, Abden?
Well, the people in Ireland, the IRA types who would become Dave Rupert's critics when they realized he was an FBI mole, would say that the FBI entrapped him because of all his bankruptcies, money he owed the IRS, other problems he'd had in his life. From all our research that Bob and I have done, it doesn't look like that. It looks like he just happened to be drinking with these IRA guys he'd met through his girlfriend, and they slap a picture. When the FBI shows up at his office, all these things are running through his mind. Shit, is it the 750 grand that I ran off with without paying, you know, from that last, you know, failed business venture? Is it some of these shady people that I've done deals with over the years? No, it's a picture of him and this pub owner. And Rupert hasn't done anything with the IRA. He's been hearing them out. You know, they're trying to convert him to being a, you know, true believer in the Irish cause. And it's good pub talk. He's humoring them. When they slap that picture down and they realize that's all it is I'm hanging out with these guys, Rupert's relieved. He exhales, oh, geez, I thought you might have had something on me. No, these are just friends of mine that I hang out with. And they're like, how'd you like to go to work for us? Spying on them. And he thinks about it for a while. He says, okay. I'm you know, compressing time a bit here, but it took a while to think about it. But that's essentially what happened.
So you're telling me it was just for the adventure? Like, yes. In American Hustle, they very much had him by the balls. Okay. And they were squeezing. You're telling me this guy just did it because it's a challenge. It's adventure. Let's go, baby. Is that it?
Bingo. Bingo. So as you listen to these episodes, we talk about how Dave Rupert just sort of flitted from one career to another as a logger, as a pro wrestler, trying to set up hovercraft to go out to gambling boats in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, he tries a little this, a little that, whatever's fun at the moment. And the FBI says they're going to pay for his trips to Ireland. Sure. Why not? That sounds like a good deal. All he has to do is, you know, keep an eye on these folks. So they really didn't have you know, something to hang over him like a sort of Damocles. Now, he did owe some money to the IRS, and he thought, well, it wouldn't hurt to work with the FBI, then maybe they forgive me on that, which they ultimately did work a deal with him, so he got out of his debt for pennies on the dollar. But that was less of a motivation than just the soldier of fortune, let's try something new.
Well, I'd say three things to piggyback on that. Yeah, it was the adventure was definitely part of it. The other part was the, you know, not just, you know, I don't think there was anything. I mean, he's been unapologetic. Like, you know, if he's going to do it, he wants to get paid for it. The money was a motivation too, or the potential for money. But that doesn't undercut the authenticity of his role or of his mission, you know, in my mind, at least. And then lastly, I think what motivated him, or at least was a factor, was, I mean, even though he's been portrayed as sort of an amoral person, you know, I think that there was some moral righteousness in him. Not that he had a dog in the fight, but that it's like, well, if I'm going to do this, you know, and these guys are killing innocent people, it's like, you know, that's not right. So I'm good with it. So I do think that there was some moral reckoning and reasoning that was part of the equation too with him.
So wait, Bob, that's an important point. I want you to go back on that. So when the FBI was selling him on being a spy, did they sell it on him by, you'll be doing a greater good by stopping terror? Is that how they sold it to him? How, like he was, it was almost like he was a spy in World War II that was going to bring down the Hitler. Was it? Did they? Is that how they pitched to him? I guess Abden wants to answer this question. Go ahead,
Abden. Before Abden does, funny thing. There is a Hitler angle as well in there that is a little hidden gem within our podcast with the IRA. But anyways, go ahead, Abden.
I should say initially, Ben, the answer is no. I don't think they had to do any salesman job with Rupert. You know, Ed Buckley, the FBI guy, shows up in his office and makes the pitch to him, hands him his card. Rupert takes the card, puts it in his pocket, says, I'll think about that. And we have a good story there, too. And he eventually decides to do it. It's not until the end, because initially his role there is just to go over and keep his eyes and ears open. You know, the FBI wants to know about money and guns coming from Chicago and other U.S. cities to Ireland, and they want Rupert to be their eyes and ears there. There's a lot of mission creep over the 7 years of his operation there, where he gets much further than any of them ever expected he'd go, and he works his way right up to the top, right to the next top guy, Mickey McKevitt. And then it has to change and become, they want him to testify. It's like, wait a minute. Now you're asking me to do something. And at that point, then the salesman of, you need to do this for the good of the cause, for the good of Northern Ireland, for the good of Ireland. That's when they have to start prevailing on his sense of moral duty.
Wow, man. The FBI is slick. They got him in the game. And then it was like, when he couldn't get out, it was like, come on, big guy. We'll give you a witness protection. Let's go. Speak up.
But also, I mean, there's a slickness to that point. Like, the FBI absolutely was like not slick at first, you know, like, I mean, like they were okay with him sort of drifting off to sea at some point. Cause they didn't foresee the success, you know, they didn't foresee his value, and he didn't have value initially really that much. It grew over time, and he had to sell them on his value, which is really interesting. There were multiple occasions where the security services, not just the FBI, but the British, the Irish, whatever, and we chronicle some of this, you know, basically behaved really stupidly and, you know, would have been fine with him just being cut loose and you know, and not going ahead with this. And, you know, they weren't going to pay him, and then they were, and then they kind of allegedly went back in their word. And then it was, well, we didn't exactly say that, you know, a lot of different things that they sort of fumbled toward the goal line.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Which episode is it, Bob, where we open with one of, you know, he's got Joe Buckley's card, the FBI, his little card is with the FBI, yep. Ed Buckley, sorry. Joe Buckley's my brother-in-law. So he's got Ed Buckley's card and he's goes back to Ireland and he's hanging out with, you know, one of the targets that they want him to keep an eye on, one of these pub owners who's very involved with the IRA, Joe O'Neill. And they go to Dublin to his party office because he's an elected town councillor, and then they're driving back and Joe has to go to an IRA meeting. Now, he's friends with Rupert, but he doesn't trust Rupert enough to bring him to a meeting yet. So he drops him at a hotel, says, here, hang out here. I'll come back and get you. And Rupert goes through his wallet and sees, oh, shit, here's Ed Buckley's FBI card. What if Joe and his IRA buddies come back and find this on me? What the hell am I going to do? Should I flush it down the toilet? No, you got to flush it three times. It may not go. Should I burn it? No, they're going to ask what the hell I'm burning. He slices it up and he starts peeling into little pieces and he eats the damn thing.
Yeah. Man, this stuff is crazy. Listen, this guy, how do I explain this, listeners? Even in Evanston, I knew the IRA was not a group of people that you mess around with, okay? Even I knew that, Bob. So these people don't play, you know? I mean, did he know how dangerous what he was doing was? I mean, was he ignorant? Was he protected by ignorance? Or did he go, yeah, man, I'm down. I'm ready to do this.
He's just a gutsy guy.
He tends to lunge first and then think about the consequences later. Yeah, everybody knows that the IRA doesn't mess around, but he's game for adventure.
There's game for adventure, and then there's insane. Bob, why don't you weigh in, and then Abden too. on the level of sanity here. You know what I'm saying? Like, would, obviously, I don't believe either one of you would do it. To be a undercover, well, you might not do it for ideological reasons, but I mean, this is not normal human behavior. Am I correct, Bob Hergerth?
Well, I think that Dave Rupert saw something that nobody else saw. I think he's very smart. He's very driven. He's very, you know, he's gone through a million different businesses and I don't want to say scams, but like, you know, kind of like, you know, he just knows how to pivot through life. And if all the cards fall down, he knows how to, you know, move on and build it back up. And so I think I know he didn't see the end and how this would have gone, but I think he had, you know, confidence in himself and, you know, doing something, you know, and he was persistent enough that, I mean, he's the reason this all kind of happened in the end because he didn't let it drop. And was that for ideological reasons? No, it was for the adventure. It was for the money. It was for, you know, other things, but it, you know, it's still what he did ended up, you know, probably saving a lot of lives, you know? So, I mean, but I think he saw the potential and had the confidence and certainly the self, you know, the gutsiness to do this. So I won't say that's insanity. I just think that he's a very unique guy.
We'll hold off what he did save lives to a little bit. I wrote that down because I'm going to ask you to flesh that out a little bit. Abden.
He's not insane. He is a dice rolling entrepreneur who's willing to take chances. And he's got a comfort level already that he's been going over to these pubs in Ireland and chatting with Joe O'Neill and Vincey Murray, who are both very involved in the cause, in the dicey side of the cause. But as he's learning, the more times he spends with him, he would see these are the guys that, you know, Joe O'Neill as an elected town councilor and a pub owner and a singer, you know, he sings the songs and he gets the whole crowd riled up with these pro-IRA songs. But he's not quite grabbing a gun and going out there in the field and, you know, being a frontline soldier. So Rupert doesn't think that he's going to be in the middle of like a gun battle for this. He recognizes there's danger, but he thinks it's an acceptable amount that he's sort of nibbling at the fringes here, just going and keeping his eyes and ears open to these friendly enough IRA types that he's met.
Until the wheels fall off. Right. That's how it starts. And then the wheels fall off later and it's too late to turn back.
All right.
And not that he would.
So how, before we get to the wheels falling off, this, by the way, folks, this is a great story. And we'll go back and give another plug for the podcast itself because they're not giving all the details here. You don't want to give away all the details of your, because then people, I heard it on the Ben Jarosky Show. Why do I have to listen? Oh, you want to listen to it. Okay. Well, you're driving in your car or whatever.
And it's a Chicago story. You know, I mean, it's about Ireland, but it is significantly about Chicago. It's not just accidental that this guy lives in Chicago. There's a huge component of this whole spy operation that takes place in Chicago into the 2000s.
Yeah. Wow. That see, ladies and gentlemen, that's where I was getting at earlier. Politically speaking, Chicago, the Irish, the 19th Ward, they just went nuts over Vallis. Okay, they just like voted down in the 19th Ward, which is, I think Bob and Abden would agree, there's quite a few Irish Americans who live in the 19th Ward.
A few.
The greatest vote against the tax, the one-time tax on expensive property, probably not much of which is in the 19th Ward, came from the 19th Ward. So this is where, politically speaking, if you look at like the 19th Ward attitude toward a Dexter Reed, we've had this conversation. I'm not going to drag you guys into this, but the Dexter Reed shooting has been a big topic of conversation on this show. It's conservative. And yet Chicago is like, as Bob and Abden are saying, is like ground zero in some ways to funding and supporting one of the most radical organizations of its time. Go ahead, Abden.
What better way to get in touch with your Irish roots and which side you should be rooting for than listening to this podcast? I'll do an aside here and a great Chicago story here. That it starts in the 19th Ward because one of these Chicago fundraising groups that Rupert is infiltrating here in Chicago, Now, in fine Chicago fashion, he's going to make himself the bag man, going to these, you know, fundraising groups in Chicago where they've got the jar on the bar to for money for the cause. He said, you know what? I'm going to go. I'll be flying to Ireland anyway. I'm a rich businessman flying back and forth to Ireland. The FBI is covering all his trips. He's not really a rich businessman. That's just his cover. But he shows up in Ireland with envelopes full of money. You show up in Ireland with envelopes full of money, people are happy to see you. So that helps him ascend the ranks of the groups in Ireland. But here in Chicago, and you know, Bob and I went to some of these meetings. It's a small ragtag group of folks that are still, even as Jerry Adams and Martin McGuinness are taking most of the IRA and most of the American supporters in a new direction, going the political route. These are the folks that want to keep up the military end of things by setting the bombs in Ireland, by raising money for that, you know, here in Chicago, or supporting the groups that are doing that and their families. So into one of these groups, Dave goes and he meets this girl who's from the 19th Ward. Her dad's a cop. This is, you know, classic Chicago, you know, 19th Ward, Irish, Beverly. All my aunts and uncles live down in Beverly. God bless them. They're on the right side of things, I believe. But so Rupert, you know, the FBI sets him up with a phony trucking office on Halstead Street down in Canaryville. He's got nothing else to do. So he's rents a program to teach himself how to do websites. This is when the late 90s websites are just becoming a thing. And he does the website for the Friends of Irish Freedom. And then when, like most of these little Irish groups do, they have infighting and they splinter into another group and it becomes the Irish Freedom Committee. He does the website for the Irish Freedom Committee. So the girl here who, you know, the 19th Warder, has just gotten herself appointed the campaign office manager for Glenn Pichard, who is a candidate for governor in 1998. This is actually 1997, early 1998. You got a four-way Democratic primary for governor. These guys are going to take on George Ryan. You got John Schmidt, the mayor's former chief of staff. You got Roland Burris, the attorney general. Jim Burns, the U.S. attorney. And Glenn Pichard, who's a downstate congressman from as far down south in Illinois as you can get, where you're closer to Memphis culturally and physically than Chicago. And, you know, this guy's, he's pro-life, he's pro-gun, he's very uncomfortable with the gay marriage. So tough sell in Chicago, though it's very popular in the area that he's at. But so this girl is his office manager, and she says to Dave, hey, would you do the website for our candidate for governor? And Dave's thinking, he's really trying to impress these folks and make an alliance with her and get into this. But he has to ask the FBI, okay, this candidate for governor of Illinois wants me to do his website. Should I? And they're like, all right, just don't screw it up. Well, he screws it up. He gets in there. And first of all, so he grabs some campaign literature. He goes to Ireland to the IRA safe house that Joe O'Neill is running in Ireland. He sets up the candidate's website. And this, you know, Glenn Pichard, I said, did you know that your website was set up in an IRA operative's house in Ireland? No, I didn't know that. The website is not too bad. It's two pages. These are the early days of website. It's probably not quite as nice as John Schmidt's, but Pichard had a noble stand. He didn't want to take any big donations, no PAC money, so no donations over $2,000. That means he's got a lot of small donors. He wants them all listed on the website. So Rupert is entering all these donor data at the IRA safe house in Ireland, at his phony trucking office on Halstead. And eventually the computers just can't hold it. And he says, okay, I need to reformat it, but back it up. And the campaign says, okay. And he crashes the whole damn website. They lose all the data. And he and this girl have to leave the campaign, and it's kind of over. Luckily for Pichard, his campaign recovers, and he goes on to win the Democratic primary, though he ultimately loses the general election. But this is just one instance of Dave Rupert sort of having these Forrest Gump moments where he sort of stumbles into history as he's doing his covert operation.
No, that's a great side story. And I got a big kick out of it. I won't go down that path because I could talk about believe it or not, gentlemen, I could talk about the 98 Democratic primary for governor.
Wait, you like to talk? You're not a talker.
What? Oh, my God. But that's one of my, I can't believe that. It was the 98 Democratic gubernatorial primary. It was one of my favorite elections of the 90s. And the fact that this guy stumbled in on it while he's spying on the IRA for the FBI, I'm telling you guys, go see American Hustle. It'll blow your mind. First of all, you'd be mad that you didn't watch it when it first came out 10 years ago. But the parallels are unbelievable. It's like there's certain operatives, there's certain hustlers, there's certain wheeler dealer types that just have that ability. And Bob, I don't know if it's sanity or insanity. That may be the wrong choice. Yeah. That, you know, I may have gave you the wrong choice. It just may be like just this like
ballsy. This
ballsy, and they don't care. And they know that they shouldn't probably do it. They know it's not in their best interest to do it, but what the hell? Let's go for it, man. And they do it. A guy like me, very cautious guy, I'm going to stay at home and watch Bosch. I mean, I'm not going out. And they don't view the world that way, you know? And it just, they don't view the world that way. And so old boy is doing Glenn Burchard's website from a safe house. An IRA safe house just blows my mind. Glenn Burchard has no idea, by the way. For the record, I did vote for Glenn Burchard in the 98 gubernatorial election against George Ryan. Just had to say that, Abden. I struggle with that one. Everybody else in my family voted for George Ryan because of the abortion issue. But
George Ryan was the guy that killed the ERA. So you weren't doing yourself any favors, but yeah, we don't need to. He killed the ERA. Relitigate that.
I feel Abden and I had this argument in 1998. All right, let's move on. So Bob, here's my question for you. How in the world did he get to the point where he reached the top of the IRA? Mickey McKevitt, who is this notorious figure in Ireland. Why don't you explain a little bit who he is, what he represents, and then the two of you explain to me how this man, this website designer with a trucking firm in Canaryville, pumped up by the FBI, who somehow or other building a website for a conservative Democrat named Glenn Burchard, who's so conservative that Ben's mother didn't vote for him. How in the world did this guy insinuate himself to the top? Go ahead.
I mean, obviously the IRA screwed up, you know, severely along the way, and they let their guard down and they didn't adhere to the normal standards of secrecy, because he's almost so audacious, you know, that it's like, well, who he is and what he represents is so audacious, he can't possibly be a spy, I think was their thinking. And it was like, sometimes what's before you is what's before you. And they didn't see it that way. Hey, but also, I mean, Rupert's very smart. You know, okay, he's from this like kind of quaint rural background. His education isn't super, whatever. It doesn't matter. I mean, this guy is, you know, incredibly smart and savvy. And he's also incredibly engaging. I mean, he can bullshit with the best of them. And he did. You know, I mean, truly, I mean, think about, I mean, look at sales, right? The most successful salespeople are those who can just talk and are just engaging and regular and just regular folk who are just, you know, could just be entertaining and you want to be their friend, right? And then they'll sell you a bunch of, you know, modems or whatever, you know, and, you know, that's what this guy was. He's really engaging and he hit it off with McKevitt at a time that McKevitt needed money, needed American support. He was desperate to keep the fight going. And so he let his guard down, but he was in need. And then they hit it off. And I think that was it.
Abden, you want to add anything to that?
When you're 6'7" and 300 pounds, you have to learn how to be non-threatening, to put people at ease, to make them relax. I'm not going to hurt you. And so Rupert had this very unassuming sort of low-key style where he could put you at ease, and he had these folksy mannerisms. So he learned how to be, as Bob says, a good salesman and how to spin a good yarn. Anything from his past he could pick up to be engaging stories, he would play off all his wives and ex-wives and his bankruptcies and his rises and failures in the business communities.
Were documentable if they had ever wanted to. It's not like they weren't true. That was all true and provably so. So he was credible.
So when it gets to Mickey McKevitt, it's at a time when McKevitt is somewhat under siege. As Bob says, he needs American backing. He needs friends. Mickey McKevitt, there weren't a whole lot of people presenting themselves to, hey, let me help you. So here comes this American with money, with knowledge about the Irish, because he's been schooling himself on, you know, the Irish history. And they wanted to believe that Rupert was their savior.
And as I understand it from your podcast, Mickey McKevitt was sort of a holdout in many ways. Like the it seemed as though the situation was evolving toward one of negotiation and away from terrorist attacks. And then there was that bombing that you guys, it was very upsetting part of the, I forget which episode, but there was a bombing in a marketplace and something like 29 people. Oh my, yeah, thank you. 29 people were killed, and I was like, oh, you know, this is like still the bad boy of the group, very much so, as everybody else is moving toward peace and compromise. And so he insinuates himself with Mickey, I guess, very dangerous on his part. All right. So here's the question I have for you. I don't know if it's Abden or Bob I should ask this question to. So whoever it applies to, open up. How did you meet David Rupert?
When the news first surfaces in 2001 that Mickey McKevitt has been arrested, is going to stand trial in Dublin for directing terrorism, and the main witness against him is going to be a trucker from Chicago named Dave Rupert, you know, Herg and I look at each other like, who the hell is Dave Rupert? We've been covering the Irish community in Chicago forever. Nobody's ever heard of some guy named Dave Rupert. And, you know, I know some of these folks in the fringe, you know, Chicago groups that are still raising money for the militant side. And we just start interviewing them. We start doing stories where we're talking to these folks, you know, Frank O'Neill, who ran the pub on the West Side, you know, old IRA guy, been involved with the cause for years. This group that went from being the Friends of Irish Freedom to the Irish Freedom Committee as they, you know, schism and splinter. So we start interviewing these folks and doing stories, and then independent, but we can't find Dave Rupert. He's in witness protection. He's nowhere to be found. So independent of that, Dave Rupert is looking for someone to tell his story, to do a book. So he searches out the reporter in Chicago with the most Irish sounding name, Flynn McRoberts, who's over at the Tribune. And, you know, Flynn's a friend of mine. He knows I'm into the Irish stuff. So he calls me in. So we go to meet with Rupert. And, you know, we make it very clear that, listen, if we're going to do a book about your life story, we're not going to pull any punches. We're going to talk about all your bankruptcies, all your divorces. And he was totally cool with all that. He, you know, hold nothing back as long as, you know, he is, as Herg found out from talking to his family members, you know, he is coin operated. So he wants some cash out of the deal. You know, he would want, if a book's going to make money, he wants a cut of it. But that's sort of how we got to meet Rupert, was from the book deal. Flynn has to go work on another book. So then Herg gets to come in, and it's then Bob and I that are doing the book with him.
Wow. Bob, are you Irish American?
Yeah, I'm half.
Half. Okay. So you have some sense of it. Let's talk about that. Why need an Irish guy to do it? I could have done that book. I'm not Irish. Rupert, I could have done as good a job as Abden and Bob on that story. So why does he feel he needs an Irish guy?
I think somebody that cares and understands the issues, you know, which we both do, maybe Abden more than I, but we both, you know, grew up with this sensibility and understanding the politics a little bit over there and the culture and the history, certainly. And so it just worked out. And Dave didn't feel, you know, I mean, I think that he wanted somebody that could help convey all that.
Guys, I was just kind of kidding with that. Good choice, Dave. Okay. I'm not saying I would have been better. I'm just saying, Dave. Huh?
Yeah.
Help a brother out. All right. Wait. So just think about how ballsy this dude is. Just what you said, Abden. You just kind of glided over that. Think about it. Word breaks that he's going to testify against Mickey McKevitt, who's this notorious bad man, okay, in terms of like ordering operations that people die. All right, follow me in this, Abden. At the same time, he's about to do this, which is a life-threatening thing. Ordeal he's going to go through. He's looking for a writer in Chicago to write his story. This is not a normal human being, Bob Hergeth. I'm sorry. I don't know if this moves into insanity, but it's pretty damn close. It's Trump-like. I don't know if you can filing Donald Trump's cases. He's got four cases right now. Go out. He'll say anything at any time. And so go ahead. I'm going to cut you off. Go ahead.
Now, part of the deal is that we're going to do the interviews with him now, but we can't start marketing the book to a publisher until after the trial. We don't want to screw up the trial. He would like McKevitt safely convicted and behind bars before we, you know, start putting the book out. So he does have some thought that goes into this. But yeah, he thinks he's got an interesting story to tell. He thinks there's money to be made.
What'd you say, Bob?
The book never happened, but we hung on to the tapes. And because these producers out west stumbled across my FBI files because they're doing a different podcast on an FBI investigation in Chicago, we got to talking. I suggested this. They asked about ideas. I suggested this. And then we're back to the races because we have the tapes.
Podcasting, guys, is the way to go. You guys, but I'll give you a shout out. You're really good on the mic and you tell the stories. And it's well done. If you're in a car, this is the perfect like thing to listen to when you're in a car. It just unfolds. You're taking a long trip. If you're a trucker going to Canada, all right. Abner, you don't want to give too much of this away, but tell what you can. You got in trouble of sorts. You're about to go do some jail time. That was a dude. To protect a source. Boy, I tell you what, would I go to jail to protect a source? I got to think about that, Abden. Go ahead, tell the story.
So we, you know, this is what you learn in journalism school. You promise someone anonymity or say we're off the record, you know, you go to jail to protect a source. Now, this is a little different because our source was known. Everybody knows we're interviewing Dave Rupert, but you know, I get a call, we're doing our interviews with Dave Rupert, finding out this story because we didn't know. You know, was he a mole to begin with? Was this a true believer who turned? Was it? And as we find out the story that he just sort of fell into this, it's even more fascinating than we might have imagined. But we're, you know, Bob and I are interviewing him and starting to put together the bones of a book deal we'll shop to a publisher. I get a call from the FBI saying, okay, I'm going to need all your notes and tapes of your interviews with Rupert. And I'm like, get lost. We got a First Amendment. I'm not going to show you nothing. What has happened is the trial actually starts in Dublin, where Rupert is seated as the main witness, and the discovery laws in Ireland, meaning in advance of a trial, the defense lawyers for the accused have a lot more rights in Ireland than in other places, because sort of the reaction of against 800 years of British oppression is, you know, you actually have some rights. So they learn that we're doing with these interviews with Rupert, and they say, we want to see and hear everything that Rupert has told them to see if it's anything different than what he's saying here on the stand. So the request goes through the Irish government, to the FBI, to my phone. So, you know, I say no. So they hire an American firm to, you know, that files a suit in Chicago. And I just happen to be the federal courts reporter. So, you know, one of my fellow reporters there in the courtroom at the federal courts building says, Abden, now, why are you on the docket for tomorrow? I'm like, that's interesting. So they've come in here seeking an ex parte order, meaning without our knowledge, to compel us to turn over our notes and tapes.
Just tell us who the they in that sentence is. They filed, would be they hired the, a firm.
Yes, the McKevitt's lawyers are trying to get an American judge to order us to turn over the notes and tapes of our interviews with Rupert.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
So we hire some good First Amendment lawyers overnight. You know, they show up there and argue the case that we shouldn't have to turn the tapes over. And the law here is on very shaky ground, the reporter's privilege law. And I didn't appreciate it. I've gotten to know it much better over the years since. But there was a case, 69, Brandsburg, where it's so clear. It's a bunch of different cases in which reporters are doing the right thing and promising sources anonymity in order for them to get to talk so that you can actually get the stories. The stories we would not learn if the reporters could not offer the subjects anonymity. And that completely goes over the head of the Supreme Court justices who ruled against the press in one of these 4-4-1 decisions where Justice Lewis Powell's concurring opinion that says there has to be a balancing test between the rights of the reporter to protect a source and a prosecutor to get his information. And this balancing test, First Amendment lawyers have made very good law over the years on that. Unfortunately, this case, the judge ruled against us. He said, No, I think that, and this is unusual. It's not too often that an American court shows this sort of deference to a request from a foreign court. And it's not even from the court, it's from defense lawyers. But he said that, no, they thought that they ought to have access. He didn't require us to turn over the notes, but did require us to turn over the tapes. And, you know, Bob and I said, no, we're going to fight this. We're willing to go to jail. You know, we have them draft an appeal that we filed with the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals overnight. Herg, let me let you jump in here and
go ahead. Yeah,
tell some of the story if you like.
Story. As long as you're telling, tell it. Go.
No, it was just a very uncomfortable, unpleasant situation, and it was very surprising. Didn't see this a coming. I think it was very unusual and frankly very wrong for a U.S. federal judge to heed the request of a foreign court, not even a court of, you know, a batch of attorneys in a foreign jurisdiction, to turn over, you know, our notes and our tapes and to order it so done. It was just bizarre. And I think it was influenced in part by the tenor of the time. Keep in mind, this is shortly after 9/11 and the vibe on terrorism was very different. Nobody wanted to be seen as soft or whatever, or just more deferential to the issue. And so I think that influenced things. And, you know, we were a little bit of a different situation too, because even though we were acting as reporters, I mean, we did have a book deal with the guy, you know, with Dave Rupert, and we were, you know, we weren't ghostwriting him. I mean, we were writing him, and we had an agreement to tell the truth and do a full reporting job and call it like we see it, even if it's negative to him. And he was fine with that. But, you know, we did have a collaboration agreement with him on this. So the judge basically, I don't think, fully saw us as journalists in this setting. And then also it didn't help that Dave basically said, go ahead, turn over the note. You know, I'm good with it. So if my recollection correct?
There was a problem just as we're going to trial on this. So they have him up there on the stand in Dublin. And McKevitt's lawyers have the presence of mind to ask, hey, you've got these American reporters that you're working on a book deal with. We want the notes and tapes. Do you have any objection if they turn over the notes and tapes? Now, at this point in the American courtroom, the prosecutor jumps up, says objection. That question doesn't get asked. There's no similar, you know, dynamic there in the Irish courtroom. So Rupert's just sort of up there not wanting to look obstructionist. So he says, oh, absolutely not. Well, that kind of
rug out from under us. He's good with him being turned over.
Yeah. So exactly. Then why don't you turn him over? If the source that you are protecting didn't care that you were no longer protecting him, why did you turn him over?
He said he didn't care.
But the issue is here, we're standing for the principle that we can sit down with a source and click on the tape recorder and let them speak freely without worrying about who they're offending. He can bitch about the Irish cops. He can bitch about the American justice system, the British system, which he does all that, and trust us to use our discretion which of that we're going to put in the book and which we're not going to put in the book. He just didn't want to seem obstructionist. That's why he said that. So we still thought we were standing for the right principle in fighting for this. We had drafted an appeal overnight to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. We're supposed to turn over our tapes that morning. So our court lawyer is going to court and say that we've just drafted an appeal and filed an appeal to the Seventh Circuit. McKevitt's lawyers demanded immediate fines and jail time for us. I told my 8-year-old son, you know, I might have to go to jail for this. He said, will you be out in time for my birthday? So, you know, Bob and Flynn and I are pacing like expectant fathers there in the lobby of the Sun-Times as we wait for, you know, how this day is going to go, you know. And within a couple hours, we get a note down from the Court of Appeals that no, our appeal is denied, and it's a one-page unsigned order. So I don't even know, are these the guys I would expect to rule against me? Are these the folks that I expect to inform me on the Seventh Circuit? Had no way to know the strategy there. So we say no. We'll go. Let's appeal again. We'll dig in our heels, and our lawyers say no. Listen, right now you've just got, you know, a district court judge ruling against you. If you push this to a full appeal, the speed with which this came down means they're going to rule against you. So better to just cut your losses now. So we did. We said, okay, we'll turn over the tapes. You can shut down the whole appeal. It's all over. And the next day, this was the 3rd of July. The next day was the 4th of July. It was a federal holiday. It was a Friday. So all of downtown is shut down. So Bob and I have to go retrieve our tapes from the Cheney-esque secure locations we'd hidden them in and bring them down on the 4th of July to hand them over to the FBI. The FBI took the tapes, gave us a receipt. What did the guy say to you when you handed it to him, Bob?
Something like, no hard feelings, guys.
No hard feelings, yeah.
Wow.
But it was also, there was some negotiation in the middle there where it's like, I mean, we had our source and collaborator, Dave, was like, I'm fine with you guys turning it over. So it wasn't like we were screwing over a source, which you know, we would not have done. Our source was okay with it. And then we said, but we're not turning over our notes. So we kept the notes and turned over the tapes.
And did you keep a copy of the tapes?
Yes, and that's why
you'll hear. You'll hear many of those tapes on the podcast. Now we're not saying exactly what happened, but you will hear the tapes on the podcast.
No, so I know we thought. Go ahead.
We thought it was all over. Mm-hmm. A month or two later, much to our shock and horror and chagrin, here comes down a full opinion from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals saying, there's no such thing as reporter's privilege, and every court that's ever recognized it, they're all wrong. And this is from the notorious Judge Richard Posner, most published judge who publishes twice before breakfast, which leaves him no time to ever read the briefs, which is why he gets so much wrong. That's sort of been luckily it only applied to the Seventh Circuit, to the Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. So then the choice is, well, do we appeal that to the full U.S. Supreme Court and take a chance on screwing people in the other 47 states? And we said, no, we'll leave it well enough alone here. But we did have, we had every news organization in the country, you know, the New York Times, AP, CNN, ABC, all join with us, file an amicus brief on our behalf, asking for an en banc rehearing, asking Posner's fellow justices to try to rein him in and say, listen, you don't need to throw out all of reporters' privilege just because, yeah, in this case, it's this unique set of circumstances. But such was Posner's force of personality that they wouldn't go against him. So
Damn. That
decision stands.
Wow, that's powerful. And that decision is still in the books governing the states?
McKevitt v. Palish stands like a loaded gun every time you go into federal court trying to protect a source. Luckily, there's been some good rulings since. Geraldine Sopron had a great ruling protecting John Conroy and all his stories about the the coerced confessions down at Area 2 and John Burge, where she said, listen, McKevitt v. Palish, Posner says a subpoena to a reporter should be treated like a subpoena to anybody else and just evaluated on its reasonableness. Is it reasonable to ask John Conroy to go back over, 20 years of notes and figure out what's admissible and what's not? No, it's not reasonable, so I'm throwing this out. And the R. Kelly cases, that was part of my 20 years of my life trying to, bring R. Kelly to justice for his sexual assaults on underage girls. And we failed the first time. He got acquitted there. And in that case, the state court judge, Vince Gaughan, just didn't understand the law. That was very clear that he shouldn't have put Jim DeRogatis on the stand and forced him to ask questions about the tape, but he did. But in the second case, in the federal court, where they were, in theory, we should be on, shakier ground there in the federal courts with the McKevitt v. Palish ruling, the judge in that case, I think it was Judge Leinenweber, absolutely saw through and said, no, there's no need to put Jim DeRogatis on the stand here in this case. So he didn't have to testify in the second R. Kelly trial.
Posner's no joke.
Yeah.
I always thought it was Posner, but now you say it's Posner. Now I'm going to have a mental block in that. But come on, Posner. You're smarter than that. That's unbelievable, man. Who is your lawyer, by the way?
We had Damon Dunn, who was the Chicago Sun-Times lawyer, and also Kathy Roach from Sidley and Austin. So we had some very good lawyers.
Out. This wasn't for my beloved Bright One. This was independent. The Sun-Times went to bat for you anyway?
Yes.
They helped anyway.
Damon would have done it for us, regardless of whether or not the Sun-Times helped out, but the Sun-Times stepped in. Flynn McRoberts, who was, not even part of the book deal anymore, agreed to stay in it. To make it, this is the power of the Tribune and the Sun-Times working together here. So,
wow. Tribune actually did something good for once in its life. It's killing me to say that, guys. I have such a thing about the Tribune. Which do I dislike more from the 90s and the 80s and the 70s, the Tribune or the FBI? Guys, can I get back to you on that one? I'll file a brief. Fascinating.
They've done some good stories. I'm glad we have two papers in this town. It is.
Look at happen being. Yeah, they've done a few good stories. All right, I'll concede that. No, I'm just teasing. So wow, that I love that part of the story. You guys were ready to go to jail and you didn't. Well, thank you. I'm glad that you didn't have to go to jail. By the way, did they play your tapes in the court in the trial, or was it just intimidation?
So what happened was, you know, we turned the tapes over to the FBI. They spend the weekend listening to them to make sure that there's no national security problems. They turn over those tapes to McKevitt's lawyers, who then listen to them. So they're not played in open court. The McKevitt's lawyers listen to them and don't find anything different. He's not telling them anything different than he told us. So they're really of no use. And McKevitt is convicted and sentenced to 20 years for directing terrorism. Now, the one thing they found out here, they tried to make something of, was that Dave and another trucker are driving in Phoenix, Alabama, or something like that. And Dave's asleep in the back of the cab. This guy picks up a couple hitchhikers. And then the truck breaks down. They walk to the side of the road. Turns out one of the girls is a teenager, underage. We only know this because Dave volunteered this to us on the tapes. Dave was never arrested. The other guy was. But the McKevitt lawyers did try to say, you know, basically, was he doing something inappropriate with an underage girl? No. And there's no record. There's no arrest record. So that did not have any. Nothing came of that, except that all the McKevitt defenders to this day would hold that against Dave and say, see, yeah, see, he admitted to doing whatever with the teenage girl.
Yeah. Well, that's how it goes. People use whatever tools they got. All right, we're going to close this down. It's almost, we've already been going for an hour. If I keep asking questions, we'll go for another hour. All three of us love to talk. And I told Bob this is going to go down this way. He asked me how long this is going to be. I go, at least a half an hour, but you guys are big talkers. As you can see, Bob, I got the gift of gab too. Yeah, it's all good. So I'll allow Bob to close it down by telling folks where they can listen. And I urge everybody, it's two thumbs up for me. This is really a great story, well told by two outstanding journalists here in Chicago. At some levels, it's kind of brutal. But on other levels, it's just like a really compelling read that goes through your ears as opposed to your eyes. Or something. So, Bob, one more time, tell folks where they can listen to the podcast. Go ahead.
Sure. And thanks again for having us. This is fun. Always talking to you. So, it's Underbelly is sort of the series. The title of this season is The Rebel Kind. So, Underbelly, The Rebel Kind is through Entropy Media. It's available really anywhere, you know, where you get podcasts, Spotify, Google, Apple, Podcast Hero, all the sort of platforms and venues. And it's episodic. We've got six episodes out so far, I think, or seven. What do we got? And we're going to go. Okay. And we've got 12 in total that will be out every week. Every Wednesday morning they come out. And it's a great people story. I mean, this guy is really fascinating human. It's a great sort of spy, true crime, you know, thriller. It really, in essence, is a true crime story. But it's an international intrigue story, you know, with, you know, terrorists and politics and, you know, shady dealings and violence. But it's also a Chicago story. So that's what I'd say.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob. Thank you very much, Abden. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.